So we began this hour with a discussion about guns locally in the state of Connecticut, and we're going to end with a potentially significant development regarding the distribution and availability of guns globally. After years of negotiations, the United Nations General Assembly has now passed an arms trade treaty, the first of its kind to pass. The vote broke down like this: 154 for the treaty, 3 against, 23 abstentions. Saudi Arabia was one of the abstainers. The United States actually voted for the treaty. Republican senators, though, in the United States, joined by at least one Democrat, have called it a non-starter and say they'll oppose its ratification in the U.S. Senate. Treaties require a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate to become law. Rachel Stoll was a consultant for the U.N.'s lead ambassador on the treaty. She's at the nonprofit Stimson Center in Washington, D.C., dedicated to international peace and security, where she's a senior associate. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So describe what this treaty is supposed to do. Prevent rogue nations, so-called, from getting weapons that they end up using on their population to torture and reduce, if not eliminate, human rights, yes?
Yes, this is the first international treaty that will globally regulate the transfer of conventional arms. So that means that there are now common international standards that states will have to employ in order to transfer arms around the world.
What do you make of the criticism of the Cuban delegate yesterday who voted against this, or at least who voted against it, Cuba did vote against it, but
they abstained.
The Cuban argument is that this treaty ends up protecting arms exporters like the United States, protects their businesses while restricting access to weapons for countries far less powerful like Sudan.
The reality is that arms exports are a subjective business. As it is right now, countries who have weapons can decide for whatever reason they want whether or not to provide weapons to any other country. What happens now is there's more transparency in the process. The standards, the criteria that states have to take into account are out there for the world to see. And it holds states accountable, whether or not they decide to sell or not to sell. You know what criteria they're using to make those decisions.
The Australian ambassador to the United Nations, Peter Walcott, who you worked for, chaired the negotiations on developing the wording for this treaty. Listen to what he said yesterday.
Over time, it will make it more difficult for certain states, which are violators of international humanitarian law and violators of international human rights law, to get access to weapons.
Now, Rachel, the way those states get access to those weapons is typically not by signing a contract with the United States or even Russia and Brazil, also big arms exporters. It's through the shadowy sort of middle people in the arms trade that happens underground. How would this treaty affect that?
Well, there is an entire section of this treaty that looks at preventing the diversion of weapons from the legal to the illicit market, which is kind of that gray market you're talking about. And so it requires states to really take measures to ensure that when they trade weapons to another government through another country, that those weapons get where they're supposed to go and are used in the ways they are intended. So there are mechanisms within this treaty that really look at the international arms trade holistically rather than just saying you can have weapons and you can't.
So I'm a member of the opposition, huddled down in Aleppo in Syria. I'm looking at this treaty going, great, so I have no chance of getting the weapons that I need to fight the tyrant who's killing my neighbors.
Well, this treaty affects trade between states, not trade to non-state actors or to small groups. That's still within the realm of kind of what happens within a country, right? That's not what this treaty addresses. This treaty looks at the international trade between states. And so certainly that's outside the realm of this treaty. But what this will do is hold states accountable for when they do make decisions to whom they transfer to.
Now, Saudi Arabia buys a lot of weapons from the United States and then ends up transshipping some of those weapons to places in the Middle East where, you know, it has a political stake. Would this treaty get in the way of any of that? Saudi Arabia wasn't happy about this.
Well, Saudi Arabia is one of the countries, as you mentioned, that did abstain from the treaty. I would like to note that they didn't vote against it, and I think that's important. I think there was overwhelming support at the United Nations that this was a legitimate process, that there was a need for this treaty globally, and that the overwhelming majority, 154 states, as you mentioned, did vote in support of this treaty. I think what this treaty does do, however, is it does have sections on brokering, on transit and transshipment, so it really incorporates all aspects of the international transfer, and it holds states, even if they're not a party now or in the near future, it will create common standards that people accept as kind of the norm for how states should behave when transferring weapons.
So you work at the Stimson Center down in D.C., and you've got to figure that there's not a lot of chance this would get through the U.S. Senate with the bar of a two-thirds majority constitutionally to ratify, right?
Well, I think the United States ended up being a huge supporter of this treaty, and was one of the countries that brought the treaty to the General Assembly yesterday. And I think the other thing to note is this treaty is fully in line and consistent with U.S. laws, regulations, and practice when it comes to the international arms trade. The United States has the gold standard, as they like to say, for how to run an export control system. And what this treaty does is really bring everybody up to the U.S. standards, and it levels the playing field not only for U.S. industry, but also for the United States itself to say that this is the standard that everyone should try and reach up to. So the reality is there's nothing in this treaty that's inconsistent with U.S. law that will require a change in U.S. law. And it certainly makes sense for the United States to act as a global leader on something that it already does, number one. And number two, as the world's largest exporter, responsible for more than three-quarters of the global arms trade, the United States is already doing this. So right. It's only right that others meet that standard.
Sounds great. But again, that doesn't mean it's going to get ratified.
No, I think with any treaty, particularly in this country, it gets tied up in a lot of domestic politics that have nothing to do with the actual content of the treaty. And so we'll just have to hope that the cooler heads prevail and that the United States will not only sign this treaty when it opens for signature on June 3rd, but that the U.S. will be a leader in its ratification and also in the implementation, because at the end of the day, that's what's important, how the treaty is implemented, how it's applied, and how it makes a difference to people on the ground.
Finally, Rachel, sort of gut feeling, where do you think this treaty fits into the broader gun debate around the world, and include in that the attempts by lawmakers here in the United States to respond to school shootings and gun violence in the U.S.?
Well, I certainly don't think it relates to the domestic gun debate that we have in this country, in the fact that it doesn't actually touch on any of the aspects of that debate. But what I do think is that it says that the United States and other countries recognize that when you are a global arms exporter, you have a responsibility. You have a responsibility to act in accordance with international law, whether that's human rights law or humanitarian law, but you have a responsibility to protect the world's most vulnerable. And that's what this treaty does. It highlights the effect of conflict and armed violence on women, in children, on vulnerable populations, to protect them from indiscriminate attacks. So I think if we're talking about protecting youth in this country, for example, that we should also be looking at protecting youth around the world. And so I think that's where I see the relationship, but it certainly doesn't infringe on anyone's individual rights or anything of that nature.
Rachel Stoll is a senior associate at the Stimson Center. She worked on the development of the United Nations Treaty on Regulating Global Arms Trafficking that was passed yesterday by an overwhelming majority in the General Assembly. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.